A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the pigeon that's been hanging around the balcony, and he zeroed in on something we mentioned in passing. We said pigeons have saved lives and been decorated by militaries. He wants to know how homing pigeons actually worked as a communication system, and whether any pigeons are still doing this job today. Which is a better question than it sounds like, because the answer to that second part is yes.
It is, yes. And the timeline on this is way longer than people assume. We're talking continuous military use from antiquity through World War II, with some programs running well past that. The Belgian military kept a pigeon program until 2017. That's not a typo. 2017.
Belgium held the line on carrier pigeons while the rest of us were arguing about 5G.
They weren't alone. The Indian police in Odisha still use pigeons for emergency communication in flood-prone areas where cell towers go down. The BBC reported on this in 2020. They've got about 40 trained pigeons stationed across the district. When the floods come and everything else fails, they strap a message capsule to a pigeon's leg and send it.
The question isn't really, did pigeons have a job? It's how did a bird compete with telegraphs, radios, and eventually satellites, and why is it still competing in some places?
And to answer that, we have to be clear about what a homing pigeon actually is. It's not just any pigeon. It's a selectively bred variety of the rock dove, same species as the bird on Daniel's balcony, but bred over centuries for an almost obsessive drive to return to its home loft. That's the key phrase, home loft. These birds don't deliver messages to arbitrary locations. They fly one direction only, back to wherever their loft is.
Which is the first thing most people get wrong. You can't hand a pigeon an address and send it off like a tiny feathered Uber.
If you wanted two-way communication, you needed birds stationed at both ends. So a military unit in the field would carry pigeons in baskets or specially designed containers, and those pigeons had been raised in a loft back at headquarters. When the unit needed to send a message, they'd write it on thin paper, roll it up, insert it into a small aluminum capsule attached to the bird's leg, and release the pigeon. The bird would fly home. But headquarters couldn't send a reply with that same bird. They'd need different pigeons that had been raised at the field unit's location.
It's a one-way system per bird, which sounds like a massive limitation until you realize that in war, sometimes you just desperately need to get one message out.
That brings us to the core of why pigeons persisted alongside radios and telegraphs. Telegraph lines get cut, radios get jammed or intercepted. A pigeon is immune to all of that. You can't jam a pigeon. You can't decrypt a pigeon. You can shoot at it, and people certainly tried. But that's the only countermeasure.
The pigeon is the original air-gapped network.
That's actually a perfect way to put it. And the performance specs on these birds are genuinely impressive. A homing pigeon flies at 60 to 80 miles per hour. It can cover up to 600 miles in a single flight. And it does this using a navigation system that we still don't fully understand.
Let's get into that. How does a pigeon actually find its way home? Because this is the part that seems almost fictional.
The leading model is what researchers call a map and compass system. The compass part tells the pigeon which direction to fly. The map part tells it where it is relative to home, and the pigeon uses multiple redundant systems for each.
Already more sophisticated than most human engineering.
For the compass, pigeons use the sun's position as their primary reference, and they compensate for the sun's movement across the sky, meaning they have an internal clock that adjusts for time of day. They also have magnetoreception. There are iron-containing cells in their upper beaks, specifically in the trigeminal nerve, that are sensitive to the Earth's magnetic field. So even on a completely overcast day, they can sense magnetic north.
They've got a magnetic backup to their solar navigation. What's the map?
This is where it gets even stranger. The leading hypothesis involves infrasound. Extremely low-frequency sound waves below the threshold of human hearing, generated by ocean waves, wind over mountain ranges, even the subtle hum of the Earth itself. These infrasound patterns create what's essentially an acoustic landscape. Every location has a unique infrasound signature. The theory is that pigeons memorize the infrasound signature of their home loft and use these signatures as landmarks. They may also use visual landmarks for the final approach, but for long-distance navigation, infrasound seems to be the dominant mechanism.
They're navigating by listening to the planet's hum. That's not a navigation system, that's poetry.
It's also why pigeons sometimes get lost. If there are atmospheric disturbances, major storms, unusual wind patterns, it can disrupt the infrasound landscape. There are documented cases of pigeons getting confused near supersonic aircraft or during seismic events.
How do you train a bird to do this? You don't just grab a pigeon off the street and hope for the best.
Training starts when the bird is about 6 weeks old. You let it get thoroughly familiar with its loft, that's home base. Then you start taking it short distances away, maybe a mile, and releasing it. The bird flies home. Gradually, you increase the distance, always moving outward from the loft in different directions. Over time, the pigeon builds a mental map that covers hundreds of miles. The key is that you always train outward from home. You're expanding the bird's known territory, not teaching it arbitrary routes.
This whole system was weaponized, or at least militarized, on an enormous scale.
The U.S. Army Signal Corps had 54,000 pigeons during World War II. 54,000. That's a small air force. The British had their own operations under a section called MI-14D. The D was for pigeons, though it wasn't officially called that. And these birds were deployed in surprisingly sophisticated ways. They were parachuted behind enemy lines in special containers. Resistance fighters and intelligence operatives would retrieve the containers, write their reports, attach them to the pigeons, and release them. The birds would fly back to England, crossing the channel under their own power.
You're dropping pigeons out of planes in boxes, and they're flying back across a war zone carrying intelligence. This is not the pigeon on a park bench image most people have.
The containers were designed with a delayed release mechanism. The pigeon would be in a small cardboard or wicker box attached to a parachute. When it hit the ground, the operative would find it, use the bird, and send it back. If no one found it within a certain time, the box would open automatically so the pigeon could fly home rather than starve.
That's more thoughtful design than some software I've used.
Now let me tell you about Cher Ami, because this is the pigeon that really made the case for the entire program. October 1918, the Meuse-Argonne Offensive. The 77th Division, what became known as the Lost Battalion, was pinned down behind German lines. They were surrounded. They were taking friendly fire from their own artillery because no one knew their position. They'd already sent two pigeons that were shot down. Cher Ami was their last bird.
Everything is riding on this one pigeon.
They attached a message to Cher Ami's leg giving their coordinates and a plea to stop the bombardment. The bird took off into heavy machine gun fire. It was shot through the chest. It lost a leg. The message capsule was hanging by a tendon. And it kept flying. 25 miles in 25 minutes. It delivered the message. 194 soldiers were rescued. Cher Ami survived. Barely. Army medics carved a tiny wooden leg for it, and it was awarded the French Croix de Guerre.
A wooden leg for a pigeon. That's the kind of detail that makes you realize none of this is a metaphor or a cute story. This was a working military asset that got treated like a wounded soldier.
That brings us to the Dicken Medal. Established in 1943 by Maria Dicken, founder of the People's Dispensary for Sick Animals in the UK. It's essentially the Animal Victoria Cross, the highest honor for animals serving in military conflict. 32 pigeons have received the Dicken Medal. That's more than any other animal, more than dogs, more than horses. 32 pigeons.
More than dogs is saying something, because dogs get medals for bomb detection and combat tracking.
The specific stories are remarkable. Winky, in 1943, a British crew was forced to ditch their Beaufort bomber in the North Sea. They were freezing, no radio contact, no one knew where they were. They released Winky, who was on board as a messenger pigeon. Winky flew 120 miles through a storm back to the loft in Broughty Ferry, Scotland. The bird arrived exhausted and covered in oil. But the RAF was able to calculate the crew's position by triangulating Winky's flight time and bearing. They launched a rescue and saved the entire crew.
Not only did the pigeon deliver the message was, "I am a pigeon who just flew here from a specific location. Do the math."
There was no note. Winky just showed up, and the pigeon handler recognized her and knew which plane she'd been on. Then there's Commando in 1945. Commando delivered intelligence from behind enemy lines in Nazi-occupied France. Made over 90 trips. That's a career. Joe, in 1946, this one might be the most consequential single pigeon flight in history.
Tell me about G.
The Allies were planning to bomb the Italian village of Calvivecchia. German forces were believed to be occupying it. But British troops had actually captured the village ahead of schedule, and there was no time to get the message through by radio. Joe was released with a message to cancel the bombing run. The bird flew 20 miles in 20 minutes and arrived just as the bombers were taxiing for takeoff. The mission was called off. Over 1,000 Allied troops and an unknown number of civilians were saved. One pigeon, one flight, 20 minutes.
We're talking about a bird that prevented what would have been one of the worst friendly fire incidents of the war. And people think of pigeons as flying rats.
That's one of the misconceptions that really bothers me. Pigeons are extraordinarily intelligent. They can recognize themselves in mirrors, which is a cognitive benchmark that most animals fail. They can distinguish between paintings by different artists in controlled studies. They recognize individual human faces. These are not dumb animals. They were essential military personnel.
The scale of the operations is what really gets me. You mentioned 54,000 birds in the U.S. program. What did the infrastructure for that look like?
The U.S. Army had specially designed trucks that functioned as pigeon locks, each housing up to 200 birds. These would be moved as the front line shifted. The birds would be trained to the mobile loft, so they'd home to wherever the loft was currently parked. The British had similar setups, plus stationary lofts at key communication hubs. There were also pigeon stations, on ships, on aircraft, even on tanks.
A tank with a pigeon loft. There's an image.
Here's the thing that I think is most instructive for modern listeners. Pigeons weren't a replacement for radio, they were a complement. They were used when radio silence was necessary, when radios were jammed, when encryption was compromised, or when the terrain made radio communication impossible. They were the fallback that worked when the high-tech solution failed.
Which is the exact same logic behind why the Odisha police still use them. Floods knock out cell towers, roads become impassable, the power grid goes down, and a pigeon doesn't care about any of that.
The Odisha program is fascinating. They've maintained it continuously since 1946. It was originally set up during the British colonial period and just never stopped. The pigeons are stationed at police outposts across the district. Each bird is trained to fly between specific stations. They can cover about 15 to 20 miles in 20 minutes, which in a flood situation where roads are underwater and cell towers are down, is infinitely faster than any alternative.
15 miles in 20 minutes when the alternative is someone trying to wade through floodwater. That's not a quaint tradition, that's a working backup system.
The Belgian military program that ran until 2017, that was partly ceremonial by the end, maintaining a historical tradition, but it was also a recognition that you don't throw away a capability that has zero failure modes in common with your primary systems. A pigeon can't be hacked. It can't be intercepted electronically. It doesn't depend on satellites or power grids or cell towers. Its failure pattern are things like a hawk got it or bad weather confused it, which are completely orthogonal to the failure pattern of electronic communication.
This is really a lesson in what you might call orthogonal redundancy. You don't want a backup that fails the same way your primary system fails. If your primary communication network can be taken down by an EMP or a cyber attack, your backup shouldn't also be electronic.
That's the practical takeaway that I think Daniel's question points toward. We joke about using a homing pigeon when we resort to alternative communication, but the principle is sound. What's your communication fallback, and does it depend on the same infrastructure as your primary method?
Most people's backup to their smartphone is, or maybe a laptop, all of which depend on the same cell towers, the same power grid, the same internet backbone. That's not a backup. That's the same system in a different form factor.
The pigeon is the extreme case, but the principle generalizes. Mesh networks that work peer-to-peer without cell towers. Satellite messengers that use entirely different orbital infrastructure. Even just having a plan for where to meet if communication goes down entirely. These are all versions of the pigeon principle.
The pigeon principle is essentially, the best communication system isn't the most advanced one. It's the one that works when everything else doesn't.
And that runs counter to how we usually think about technological progress. We tend to view it as a linear march, telegraph replaced by radio, radio replaced by the internet, each new thing making the old thing obsolete. But that's not how it actually works. Old technologies don't always die. They find niches where they're still the best solution.
You still see courier networks in high-security contexts for exactly this reason. Intelligence agencies use human couriers for certain classified materials because you can't intercept a person carrying a physical document without physically taking it from them. It's the same logic as the pigeon, just with more legs and less flying.
There's something almost humbling about it. We've built this extraordinary global communications infrastructure. Fiber optic cables under oceans, satellites in geostationary orbit, quantum encryption experiments, and a bird with iron particles in its beak and an ear for the planet's hum can still outperform all of it in the right circumstances.
The iron particles in the beak thing is going to stick with me. We built GPS, and pigeons were already running a multimodal navigation system with magnetic, solar, and acoustic inputs.
They don't need software updates.
There's the real advantage. No firmware to patch.
I do want to address one more thing about the Dick and Metal pigeons, because there's a detail that I think captures something important. Joe, the pigeon that saved the 1,000+ lives, after the war, he was sent to live at the U.S. Army's Pigeon Breeding Center at Fort Monmouth. He lived there for another 15 years. When he died, his body was preserved and is now on display at the U.S. Army Communications Electronics Museum. He's not buried in some unmarked grave. He's in a museum. The military took this seriously.
As they should. If a human soldier had saved 1,000 lives by delivering a message under fire, we'd build a statue. Joe got a museum display, which for a pigeon is probably the equivalent.
Cher ami, after recovering from the chest wound and the lost leg, was sent back to the United States. General Pershing himself saw the bird off. Cher ami died about a year later from the long-term effects of those injuries and was taxidermied and put on display at the Smithsonian. You can still see Cher ami there.
These birds became monuments, which is fitting because they were essentially a living communication infrastructure. The pigeon loft was the server, the bird was the packet, and the message capsule was the payload.
That's not even a metaphor. That's literally how it functioned. And the packets had a 95% delivery rate in combat conditions during World War I. That's better than some email systems I've used.
95% delivery rate while being shot at. Let's see Gmail do that.
I think there's one more dimension to this that's worth exploring, which is what it tells us about the relationship between biology and technology. We tend to think of technology as something we build from scratch, silicon and code and metal. But a homing pigeon is a technology. It's a biological technology shaped by selective breeding and training, but it performs a function that we still can't fully replicate in a synthetic system.
We still don't have a drone that can navigate 600 miles without GPS, without radio control, without any external input, and land at a specific location. The pigeon does it on seeds.
It does it with a brain that weighs about 2 grams. The energy efficiency is absurd. The navigation system runs on whatever a pigeon eats. Our systems run on lithium-ion batteries and satellite constellations.
Are there other animals that could theoretically be used this way? Or is the pigeon uniquely suited?
Pigeons are unusually good at it because of the strength of their homing instinct and their flight speed and endurance. But there have been experiments with other birds. During World War II, the British briefly considered using falcons to intercept enemy pigeons, a kind of biological countermeasure. The Germans actually did train falcons to hunt Allied pigeons. It wasn't very effective, but the fact that both sides were running bird-on-bird warfare programs tells you how seriously they took the pigeon threat.
Wait, there was an anti-pigeon falcon program. That's the most medieval thing I've ever heard applied to a 20th century conflict.
The Germans called it the Falkenstaffel, the Falcon Squadron. They stationed peregrine falcons along the Channel coast to intercept British pigeons. The problem was the peregrine falcons hunt by diving, and a pigeon in level flight at 60 miles per hour is actually hard to catch. The falcons would sometimes get the pigeon, but more often the pigeon would just outrun them.
The countermeasure to the countermeasure was just speed. The pigeon's defense against the falcon was fly faster.
Which, again, is a perfectly valid engineering solution.
Let me try to pull this together into something useful. Daniel asked whether pigeons are still used, and the answer is yes, in very specific niches where their advantages outweigh their limitations. But the deeper lesson is about how we think about redundancy and resilience in our own communication systems.
I think the framework is this. For any communication system you depend on, ask what happens if the infrastructure it relies on goes away. If you're depending on the internet, what happens when the power's out? If you're depending on cell service, what happens when the towers are overloaded or damaged? The pigeon worked because its infrastructure was biological. It carried its own navigation and power systems internally. The loft was just a starting point and a destination.
The modern equivalent isn't literally a pigeon. It's any communication method that doesn't share infrastructure with your primary method. A satellite phone uses different infrastructure than a cell phone. A ham radio uses different infrastructure than the internet. Even a prearranged meeting spot is a form of communication redundancy. It's a message that was sent in advance, stored in human memory, that activates when other channels fail.
That's the thing about the Odisha Police pigeons. They're not using them because they don't have phones. They have phones. They use the pigeons because they know the phones will fail, and they've calculated that maintaining a pigeon loft is cheaper and more reliable than trying to flood-proof an entire cellular network.
Cheaper, more reliable, and completely immune to the specific failure pattern that takes out everything else. That's not nostalgia. That's engineering.
Which brings us back to the pigeon on Daniel's balcony. That bird is the same species as Cher, Ami, and Jijo, and Winky. The same biological hardware. The same navigation system. It's just not trained to a loft, but the potential is there. Every city pigeon is a descendant of domesticated rock doves that were bred for exactly this purpose. They're not wild animals that moved into cities. They're feral domesticates. They came from us.
The pigeon on the railing isn't an invader. It's a retired veteran whose ancestors had security clearances.
That's one way to put it. I'd say they're more like a decommissioned fleet. The ships are still seaworthy. They're just not carrying cargo anymore.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1900s, linguists studying Aboriginal Australian languages on Réunion Island documented kinship systems with up to 16 distinct terms for cousins, distinguished by the gender of each linking relative, a level of precision that makes the English word cousin look like a blunt instrument by comparison.
Réunion Island is in the Indian Ocean. There are no Aboriginal Australian languages on Réunion Island.
I'm not going to be the one to tell Hilbert.
No, I think we just let that one stand.
The pigeon on your balcony is a descendant of decorated war veterans. That's not sentimentality. That's a fact. And the next time you see one, you might look at it a little differently. Not as a nuisance, but as a piece of living communication history that still works, whether we use it or not.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back soon with more questions you didn't know you wanted answered.
See you then.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.